Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
Now I am become death, the destroyer of souls.
If you enjoy our show and you find our research interesting, please leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does go a long way in helping us out. You can find more about us and the research that we do by heading over to Instagram and searching our name. As always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Good evening, everyone. You may recall that I promised I would drop a special report episode today. Well, that's not quite ready just yet, but I didn't want to promise you a new episode and not deliver, so I'm dropping episode 4 of our West Memphis 3 series a few days early instead. The special report episode will drop next week, once we have completed our West Memphis series in its entirety, so don't worry about that. Now, as in the previous 3 episodes, we are going to jump straight back into the action. As previously advised, it's beneficial to you, the listener, if you listen to this series in episode order to ensure that you can easily understand what is being discussed and not miss out on any crucial details. So let's get going. This is The Case of the West Memphis 3, Part 4. What was the relationship like between Jason, Damien, and Jesse? Damien Eccles, in particular, has claimed many times that he barely knew Jesse Miskelly and that the three boys were not friends. In his interview with researcher Bob Ruff, Damien alleged that Jesse was too slow to hang out with them and that he and Jason were the only true close friends of the three. In another interview on Death Row, Damien had this to say. Quote, "Two things I don't have time for is stupidity and ugliness, and Jesse Miskelly had both of those qualities." This has been disputed in recent years, however. Vicky Hutchison did have Jesse introduce her to Damien, meaning that the two had to have known each other to some extent. Matthew Baldwin, Jason's younger brother, said that Damien, Jesse, and a girl in a truck drove over to his house, but only Damien stayed. Numerous other witnesses reported seeing them together, and the employer of Jesse's father also called them close friends. Even Jason admitted that Jesse and him had been friends at one point, calling the three of them best friends in a statement years later. Jason's parents claimed that Jason and Jesse had a falling out in May of 1993 over some stolen shirts and a stolen necklace. Deanna Holcomb, Damien's ex-girlfriend, said that he was friends with both Jason and Jesse. Officer Jerry Driver also claimed that he saw the three of them together in Lakeshore Trailer Park sometime in 1992, although this claim sounds as vague as they come to me. Different witnesses provide a more complicated picture, however. Jesse himself wrote down his close friends for the police on June the 3rd and did not include Damien or Jason. Buddy Lucas, who was extremely close to Jesse, said that he had not seen Jason in a while and that he did not like Damien, though he did add that he thought Damien could easily influence Jesse. David S., a close friend of Jesse's, claimed that Jesse was scared of Damien, while Jason C., a friend of Jason and Damien's, said that Jason, Jesse, and Damien had all been over to his house, but he could not remember if all three stayed at the same time. Jennifer Bearden, a good friend of Damien's, claimed that Damien and Jason did not like Jesse. Dino P. said that in May, Jesse came to the skating rink with Jason and Damien, but quickly ditched them to join his other friends. He didn't name who those other friends were. The best summation that I can make out of this is that Jesse, Damien, and Jason appeared to be friendly with each other, but were probably not close friends. It's certainly not true that they didn't know each other at all, though. If you think all this sounds like teenage relationship drama, I guess it essentially is. What were Jesse Miskelly's true mental capabilities? This was an important part of the trial, and something that has been heavily discussed over the years since. The defense claimed that Jesse Miskelley had a very low IQ and was easily led by the West Memphis police and others. The psychological evaluation taken by Dr. Wilkins in 1993 showed Jesse's full-scale IQ being at 72, with a performative IQ of 75 and a verbal IQ at 70. I think this subsequent information will mean more to my American and Canadian listeners than it will to any others. Wilkins gave the margin of error for the full-scale IQ as 67 to 77, and for the performative IQ as 70 to 80. In a pre-trial hearing in December of 1993, the doctor also said that the lower the IQ, the greater the margin would be for error. So in summary, the full IQ is what is used when differentiating a person's mental capabilities, while the performative IQ is problem-solving skills in a non-verbal format. It is combined with a verbal IQ to make a full-scale IQ for clarity. In 1989, Miskelley had a performative IQ of 84, a verbal of 68, and a full scale of 74. By 1992, the performative IQ was then 88, and the full scale was at 73. So the full scale IQ of 73, 74, and 72 are generally defined as in the borderline mentally deficient range, while the performative IQ of 84 and 88 are defined as low to average. The performative IQ appeared to have shifted 13 points from 1992 to 1993, while the full-scale IQ stayed mostly the same. It is worth noting that Wilkins admitted that there was some evidence that Jesse may have been malingering, i.e., faking his own lack of intelligence. This is always difficult to identify for sure, however. It is also worth mentioning that Wilkins came under criticism by another psychologist for his interpretation of the test. In Jesse's Rule 37 hearing, a different psychologist, Dr. Tim Denning, claimed to have run tests with Jesse in 2004, after one of Miss Kelly's lawyers wanted to know if he was actually competent to stand trial. This psychologist claimed that he had found Jesse to be, quote, mentally retarded, his terminology, not mine, and that is evidenced in his tests. Jesse did not malinger or appear to be faking anything on his part, Denning claimed. He believed that Miskelley was not competent to stand trial at the time of arrest. Interestingly, the psychologist who slammed Dr. Wilkins and claimed some of the tests were given to Jesse were administered improperly. You get a complicated story of Jesse's mental disabilities when you start going through witness statements. Jesse was certainly mature enough in 1993 to have a girlfriend, work odd jobs, and have a fairly wide circle of friends. However, he did receive special accommodations at school, where his reading capabilities seemed to fall far short of his age group. His mental capacities were generally not brought up in witness statements taken by the West Memphis police, though his wrestling buddies did make mention of them in an interview during the trial, saying that Jesse was slow but fun to be around. Some of these statements collected called him kind, some focused on his propensity for fights, and others claimed that he was a, quote, weasel, or stole things from other people, including his friends. Jesse also told the court psychologist William Wilkins that he took numerous drugs and huffed gas throughout his time in school, something that could significantly affect his mental functions too. There is a lot of early 90s phraseology used in the case discussion of Jesse's IQ and intelligence. It's not necessarily how they would be discussed by today's standards. Something to note. All the officers that were placed under oath testified that they did not know Jesse was slow or had any kind of mental incapacities. There is plenty of footage and interview video of Jesse out there from the time of the crimes, be it on YouTube or in the Paradise Lost or West of Memphis documentaries. Take a look for yourself and surmise how you think he comes across at the time, and if you think the police assessment is accurate and fair. So, was Jesse Miskelley easily suggestible? This was the claim made by both Dr. Wilkins and Jesse's lawyers. Wilkins wanted to introduce a test that he had run with Jesse into trial, but he was denied by the judge, who did not deem it to be scientific enough. The test basically ran a story by Jesse, asking him to bring up relevant details and then try to see if Wilkins could change his answers through pressure. The test was relatively new and, more to the point, relied a lot on working memories. A different psychologist claimed in a private hearing that the test could be seriously compromised by people with memory issues, since they would not be able to remember certain details and would rely on the psychologist to fill them in. From my very own psychology background and experience, the test seems entirely unreliable from a scientific standpoint, and I would have to agree with the judge in its value at trial. Also, even a basic understanding of Tony Corinda's 13 Steps to Mentalism will tell you that almost everyone, devoid of their IQ, is susceptible to influence and suggestibility, for those interested in the psychological science of mind magic. The defense actually tried to bring it up in trial, even after the judge ruled it would not be admissible, and they were quickly rebuked. This test was also run by Jesse's lawyer in his December interview with them in 1993. The test went in this way. The interviewers claimed someone had told them that Jesse had robbed a bank, and they thus tried to get him to admit to the crime. The details of this test were not made public until a 2009 Rule 37 hearing. In the actual transcript of the statement, Jesse denies the claims that he robbed the bank and claims the lawyer is lying for pretty much all of the recorded session. There is a long pause in the tape before the lawyer eventually changes the subject. In the hearing, the lawyer claimed that the old tape, when transferred to digital, erased parts of it, including the part that came right after the pause. Jesse had allegedly confessed right after the pause to the bank robbery. The lawyer said that there must have been a difference between the digital format and the VHS format, which had the confession to the bank robbery on it. In the same hearing, a different psychologist, who agreed that Jesse was a highly suggestible individual, admitted that the part where Jesse broke down and confessed was missing from the tape entirely that he watched. He didn't believe that the defense was lying, just that the portion proving Jesse was suggestible didn't happen to be on the tape. The prosecutor, asking him questions, would ask if he was aware that this portion wasn't on the original VHS tape, and he would say, quote, no. So the test may very well have been a bust, despite different psychologists believing Jesse was easily led by authority while being questioned. The Hollingsworth sighting. Narlene Hollingsworth and her family testified at trial to seeing Damien Eccles and his girlfriend Dominique Teer at 9:30 p.m. on May 5th at the service road near the crime scene. The Hollingsworths were driving on their way to pick up Dixie, their grandmother, from the laundromat when she was relieved from her job at 10 p.m. They knew Dominique well and testified to Damien's very distinctive presence of being dressed all in black. The prosecution would claim that they actually saw Jason Baldwin instead, though the two look nothing alike. Google their images, see for yourself and let me know. Some issues with the sighting. Number 1. It occurred at a time when Damien and Dominique had alibis. Jennifer Bearden claimed that Damien was talking on the phone with her at 9:30 p.m. And since Damien was also reported to be talking on the phone at 10 p.m. and lived about 35 minutes away from the crime scene, this would also be too tight of a timeline for him to walk home. Dominique's mother claimed that Dominique was at home the whole night. Number 2. Witness Dixie H. claimed that only Ricky and Narlene Hollingsworth came to pick her up. Narlene claimed that all her children, her ex-husband, and one of her children's girlfriends, named Sombra, came to pick Dixie up. But this would have been 11 people in one Ford Escort, as pointed out by a very skeptical defense lawyer at the time. Number 3. Narlene Hollingsworth had earlier given a statement where she claimed to have seen the victims. She was unable to describe their physical appearance correctly and said that all three boys were riding bikes when only two were. Narlene also said that one was wearing shorts when none of the victims were in fact wearing shorts on that day, and claimed that she knew where the children were going, despite not specifying how she knew. She did describe the bicycle colours accurately, I will note. Damien's missing trench coat. This was one of the most intriguing parts of the trial. Damien Eccles was well known to wear a long black trench coat around West Memphis. It was a fairly common goth alternative trend in the early to late 1990s. Well, this trench coat was not recovered into evidence when the West Memphis police went to his trailer to seize some of his clothing and belongings. Damien and his family were asked about this at trial. His sister claimed that she thought they still had it. Damien, however, said that he had three different black trench coats and that one was laying around on the floor of his bedroom when he was arrested. Regardless, none of the three trench coats were entered into evidence. One interesting note is that in 2007, Pam Hobbs claimed that Stevie Branch's dad Terry found a black trench coat near the Pipe Bridge over the bayou on May 6th. He brought this trench coat back home with him. Pam added that he returned it back to the Pipe Bridge and she did not know whether it was taken in by police following this. This was never brought up in any of the West Memphis police or in any other witness statements. An earlier statement, taken in May 1993 from Mark Byers, made a mention about a brown coat laying on the ground around the Blue Beacon truck wash, though this could be completely unrelated. It's hard to be clear. Some miscellaneous points. I wanted to include these bits of information too, but wasn't sure under what header to put them, so I'll add them here at the end of this section. A few interesting statements were collected in the days following the murders. Dominique Tia claimed that Jesse Miskelly visited her for the first time in around a year after the murders. Jesse also came to Jason's house and asked Damien to go to Blockbuster Video with him. Blockbuster Video was a common video cassette rental store chain across the United States, Canada, UK and Australia throughout the 1990s and early 2000s. FYI. It feels kind of pointless explaining this as it was such a well-known brand back in the day, but for those born after around 1998, I can totally understand if you'd never heard of it. I still have my membership card for the branch in Cardiff, last used in July 2001. According to Lee Rush, the girlfriend of Jesse's dad, Jesse was also highly emotional throughout the month of May. When asked why this was at the time, Jesse blamed it on girl troubles, but Rush did not believe he was telling the whole truth to her. If you recall, back in episode 1, I provided a brief description of the three teenagers who were arrested for the murders, Damien, Jason and Jesse. In the descriptor for Jesse Miskelly, I did note that family members, particularly his stepmother, who he was very close with, described Jesse as always being a soft, emotional and sensitive boy. Jason Baldwin was also recorded as acting a little bit unusual during the month of the murders. His mother claimed that in the days following the murders, Jason had quickly gotten rid of some weapons. None that were ever connected to the crime, I will add. But he said that the cops were trying to blame him for the murders, so he wanted to get rid of anything that could be considered incriminating. A different witness also claimed that Jason looked, quote, down in the dumps, unquote, when he saw Jason at the skating rink on May 7th. Perhaps the most intriguing piece of information was a witness statement given to the West Memphis police by Carrie M. She claimed to have seen Damien walking behind Michael Moore at around 3:30 p.m. on the day of the murders. This lines up well time-wise with witness testimony from Jennifer and Holly, who claimed to have talked with Damien at his house around 3 before he left to go to Lakeshore Trailer Park, and Ken W., who clarified that Damien arrived at Dominie's house at 3:30 p.m. However, and on the flip side to that, this timeline also completely goes against the witness testimony that placed Damien arriving at Lakeshore Trailer Park at 1 p.m. on that day. Let's dig even deeper into who Damien Eccles was. Now, I touched on some of this information back at the start of this series, but I want to go into more detail here. It does hold significant value later on. Damien before the murders. Damien Eccles was born Michael Wayne Hutchison on December 11th, 1974. He's a hugely controversial figure in this case and has been both admired like a rock star by his supporters and hated to the point of calling for his death by those who think he is guilty of the murders of the three young boys. Always dressed in black, head to toe, with big army boots, distinctive tattoos and a long black trench coat, Damien Eccles told the producers of the Paradise Lost documentary that he wanted to be remembered locally as, quote, the West Memphis boogeyman, unquote. And so he was. Locals turned out in masses during the investigation to voice stories about Damien drinking blood and taking pictures of their children. The prosecutors called him emotionless and claimed that he didn't have a soul. Supporters, on the other hand, labeled him as a gifted kid with offbeat interests and being the victim of a witch hunt. Much of the information we have about Damien prior to arrest is compiled in a large pile of documents named Exhibit 500. It was originally a strategy from his defense lawyers, organized to get him a mitigated sentence if he was convicted. Their hopes were that the documents, which described various family dysfunctions and a history of mental illness, would win him enough sympathy to get him off death row. I'm surprised at this train of thought from the defense, however. Mental illness, particularly back then, has never garnered much sympathy from an American jury. It was a ballsy move. The documents begin in May of 1992. There are no prior mental health records to this date. Damien's sister accused their stepfather, Jack Eccles, of sexually abusing her. Both Damien and his mother believed she was telling the truth, and Damien's mother and stepfather divorced later that same month as a result. Though this has little to do with Damien, Damien's mother believed that Damien needed counseling because Damien thought he was, quote, smarter than everyone else and had little regard for others. She also claimed that they fought on occasion. This behavior from Damien was observed during trial and in subsequent interviews. Damien did not have a good level of education and dropped out of high school before completing. But his comments show him to believe that he is of superior intellect to many others. Family dysfunction is a large theme both in the Exhibit 500 documents and in later witness statements taken after Damien's arrest. Though Damien denied any sort of abuse, he frequently claimed to various psychiatrists and therapists that he had no feelings towards his family and that he hated both his stepfather and biological father, who got back together with his mother in 1992 after not being in Damien's life for quite a long period of time. Damien stated that he did not like his sister because, quote, she wanted to be like him and that bothered him a lot, unquote. Damien did not exactly have kind words for his mother either, despite claiming that he believed, quote, she was in his favor, unquote. His mother said, in Damien's writ of error documents, that Damien's biological father, who he lived with in Oregon for a short time in 1992, may have been physically abusive towards Damien and once threatened to break Damien's arm. Damien's stepfather, in addition to the sexual abuse allegations, was also possessive of Damien's sister. He was also allegedly mentally abusive to both of his stepchildren, according to family friends and neighbors. Pamela Eccles did not believe Damien's stepfather was physically abusive, though she told the West Memphis police in a statement on May 12th that it was possible. Damien's stepfather also may have been responsible for a frequently asked question, that being Damien's name change. Damien changed his name as a teenager from Michael to Damien. Damien told someone when staying at the Charter Hospital of Little Rock in June that his stepfather had requested he change it because Jack Eccles, his stepfather, was a devout Catholic. Jack had requested it of Damien at age 10, though Damien would not change his name until a few years later. Damien later claimed in both trial and to a social worker in August of 1992 that was the catalyst behind the name change and not Jack. Damien had been interested in Catholicism at the time and admired Father Damien, who tended to lepers on the Hawaiian island of Molokai. Some have since alleged that he may have named himself after the demonic boy character in the movie The Omen, though Damien strongly denies this. The prosecution made some dubious noises about the given reason for the name change at trial. Damien's first stay at a mental hospital would soon follow the sexual abuse allegations on June 1, 1992. He was admitted to the Charter Hospital at Little Rock. This was after being arrested for burglary, sexual misconduct, and breaking and entering. Damien later added to the charges, telling the hospital that he was also arrested for terroristic threatening and disorderly conduct. This was not reflected in the actual arrest record, however. All these charges were related to one single event. Damien had run off with his girlfriend Deanna to have sex in an empty trailer. Deanna's parents did not like Damien and did not want the two to be together and conducted several interventions to break them up. Damien was determined that his girlfriend's parents would not keep them apart. That much is clear and admitted by all parties. Other parts of the story remain pretty murky, however. Various documents refer to Damien threatening Deanna's parents and also the officers that came to arrest him during the incident. This was not reflected in the initial report, however. The allegations came later from Damien's parole officer, Jerry Driver. Damien himself claimed that he would have taken the cap off the officer's gun to shoot the father if he threatened Deanna, but did not admit to any of the threats beside that. Damien was sent to the hospital after expressing plans to commit suicide while in the detention facility. From the numerous reports compiled there, we can start to see a more complete version of Damien's history. Damien said that he had been suspended from school 7 times prior due to setting fires. He also referred to a fight with a classmate named Shane D, who also gave a statement. The fight was over a girl, and Damien attempted to gouge out his classmate's eyes. There was also reports and witnesses to Damien chasing a child with an axe, though Damien would deny this incident. Many notes taken from the hospital refer to Damien as depressed and withdrawn with a flat effect, whatever this means. Damien told the hospital that he had burned himself with lighters and huffed gas and paint. Damien, however, received negative results for all the drug tests found in Exhibit 500's pages. He did have a history of physical aggression towards others and felt that his peers at school taunted him, although refused to accept that he was bullied. There was a great focus on working with Damien's rage issues at the mental health facility, and his mother specifically expressed concern to the hospital about her son's, quote, anger and rage. Damien's MMPI evaluation, or Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory Test, also made note of Damien's apparent impulsive hostility and how he may feel justified in treating others in an unprincipled manner due to perceived wrongs. It is worth noting that there were no records of aggressive behavior during his stay at the hospital, besides disruptive behavior in the classroom and irritating cat purring noises. Damien actually seemed to make some progress at the hospital. He was notably able to control himself regarding an annoying peer who was also at the facility. There were also several notes that speculated that Damien may have been suffering from auditory hallucinations due to sniffing the air and giving inappropriate smiles. Possible paranoia was recorded while staying in the facility too. Damien apparently told the staff that he believed they were watching him on a security camera situated behind his bathroom mirror and desk, which was not true, and observers struggled to identify why Damien believed this other than his own speculation. The MMPI evaluation diagnosed Damien with paranoid schizophrenia, though there are no records for Damien being medicated for it, and most other official diagnoses were generally somewhere along the line of depression or bipolar disorder. Damien claimed in trial that he was on medication for manic depressive behavior, though what was prescribed to him, Tofranil, is actually an antidepressant and is known to make manic behavior worse. There are frequent references to Damien's belief in witchcraft, including notes claiming that his parents were concerned about his beliefs in witchcraft and Wicca. Damien called himself a warlock and white witch at different points, and regularly read books on the subject of witchcraft and the occult. Damien firmly denied allegations of Satanism at this time, however. Damien was discharged from the mental facility at the end of June and went to live in Oregon with his mother and biological father. While there, he worked at a gas station for 40 hours a week. Though a home visit by a social worker in August made note that Damien was getting along well with his family, in September 1992, he made a trip to the ER at St. Vincent's Hospital in Portland, Oregon. What exactly prompted this is somewhat confusing. Notes at the time mention that Damien was both suicidal and homicidal in ideation. Most of the notes concerned threats to his father, though some notes also mention threats to cut his mother's throat. Damien did admit at trial that he threatened to, quote, eat his father alive, unquote. His suicidal ideation included telling his sister that he wanted to die and, quote, in 3 days I plan to drink bleach, unquote. The police noted that this incident only happened one time and that Damien had completely denied it. Damien's father later claimed in 2000, 6 years after Damien was convicted, that the incident preceding the hospital visit happened because Damien locked himself in a closet with a kitchen utensil. The following is a direct quote from Damien's father, Joe. Note that Joe refers to Damien by his birth name, Michael, here. Quote,
while we were in Oregon, Michael got really sad, like the time when we were driving up there. One day he locked himself up in a closet and had taken something in there with him. His grandmother told me that Michael had a knife. I thought that this was really serious, and Pam and I made him go to a hospital in Oregon. Michael got really upset with me, and I lost my temper, and after I yelled at him, he got even more upset. I feel bad about this whole incident, because what started it was when Michael's grandmother told me incorrectly that he had a knife. I do not know why I immediately trusted her instead of checking it out, but what I found out later was that Michael may have just had a spoon with him.
Damien was not held long at St. Vincent's Hospital and was soon discharged. In his physician's progress report, the doctor was extremely dismissive of Damien's suicide attempts. The doctor believed it was simply a way to avoid responsibility. The hospital did not seem too concerned about Damien's behavior at this time. Notes called him quiet but cooperative and praised his writing, though it was called morbid. Damien did not want to remain in Oregon after this incident, and he wanted to return to Arkansas. A note made in Exhibit 500 talked of Damien's depression and how he missed his friends back in Arkansas. This appeared to be endorsed by his biological parents. In his physician's progress report, the doctor claimed that Damien's parents were scared of him and what he could do to other people who were living in the house. When he did return to Arkansas, he was quickly arrested due to violating his probation, specifically threatening his father. He was sent to Craigshead County Detention Center in September of 1992 and then transferred back to the Charter Hospital of Little Rock that same month after sucking blood from another inmate. Damien claimed that this was a voluntary transaction and that he sucked blood from his peer's neck. The incident report, however, from the Juvenile Detention Center said that Damien had sucked blood from a peer's arm without warning, though this seemed to be exaggerated in some of the documents. Personally, I have to agree with that exaggeration claim. I mean, how would you suck blood from someone's arm for a period of time without them being accepting of the fact? It's very difficult to do so against an individual's wishes, unless they were, of course, incapacitated or drugged, of course, but they were not in this instance, according to the incident report. Parole officer Driver made the claim that Damien knocked the inmate down to the ground, exclaimed that he was a vampire, rubbed the inmate's blood all over his body, and forcibly sucked more blood from his arm, a claim which contradicted the incident report. Damien denied that he called himself a vampire, though a social worker claimed that Damien did in fact discuss his devil-worshipping beliefs and beliefs in vampirism with them readily in an interview on September 15th. The social worker also claimed that Damien was giggling and smiling at inappropriate moments during this interview. An initial evaluation of Damien claimed that Peers at the detention center were afraid of him and that he showed poor judgment and little insight into this illness. Staff did not believe that Damien had a thought disorder, more early 90s terminology there. A psychosocial assessment taken on September the 15th took information mostly from Officer Jerry Driver and Damien Eccles himself. It seemed to mix fact and fiction. Damien was apparently a, quote, white witch who worshipped the devil, unquote. The report also claimed that Damien had been transferred to a detention center in Oregon, which was not true in the slightest. It also made note that Damien seemed cooperative but drew occult symbols, which was, quote, concerning. There was also quite a bit of mention of the occult in Damien's progress reports, quite a lot more than Damien's previous stay just 2 months prior, in June. The report made note of this, quote, unusual drawing and poetry, unquote. Worth noting here is that much of the poetry provided in the documents actually appeared to have been song lyrics and not from the mind of Eccles. They also made mention of Damien trying to get peers to feed into Satanism, a report phrase, not mine. The progress reports also made note of Damien's history of suicide. Damien claimed that he had attempted it once before and was not afraid to die, and that he agreed that he had made several threats to people, especially male authority figures. In Damien's final discharge report, written at the end of September, it was claimed that there was no evidence of hallucinations, though there had been an earlier note about possible delusions, since Damien claimed he would be murdered within 3 days. Damien did not express aggressive actions towards peers, with the exception of a fight with another boy, and was not deemed a danger. Damien's final diagnosis was that of dysthymia, known today as PDD, or persistent depressive disorder. It's a long-lasting depressive disorder, but not considered severe. It's more of a long-term melancholy. Damien was also initially diagnosed with a psychotic disorder, which was not specified, but that was kept off the final report. In early 1993, Damien attended some counseling sessions. He told his therapist that his, quote, parents were constantly fighting, unquote, and that he, quote, tried to ignore it but eventually started fighting back, unquote. Though some notes were made that Damien seemed friendly, Damien also made some disturbing comments and statements. He said he wanted to, quote, go where the monsters go when they die, unquote. He also claimed that he hated the human race. Damien made frequent mention of his beliefs in witchcraft and Wicca, though he again denied being part of any cult. He claimed that he drank human blood to feel power, though it had to come from a sexual or ruling partner. He also stated that he had a spirit living inside of him, and that he communicated with demons through rituals, though he denied allegations of Satanism once more. Mention was again made of anger problems, which was a major goal of the sessions. Damien wanted to be able to forgive others and told the therapist that he put anger inside deep down. He also admitted that due to the anger stored inside, he blew up sometimes and wanted to hurt other people. Around the same time, Damien applied for Supplemental Security Income, or SSI, benefits. He told his therapist that his mother suggested it and asked them what they thought. Though Damien had worked before in 1991 and 1992 as a cleaner and gas station attendant, he now believed that he was no longer employable. He wrote on a federal claim form that he was treated in several mental hospitals due to being homicidal, having manic depression, drug use, being sociopathic, and suicidal and abusing alcohol. Mention was also made on the SSI forms of Damien's homemade tattoo, which read, evil, though he was also called soft-spoken by those who knew him. He was ultimately approved for full disability benefits. Records of Damien's therapy sessions taper off in February of 1993. One more record was made on May 5, 1993, where Damien renewed his prescription for antidepressants. There are other documents concerning Damien's behavior that are not found in Exhibit 500. Perhaps the most vicious action ascribed to Damien prior to his conviction were allegations that Damien brutally killed a Great Dane dog. Damien did have animal skulls in his bedroom. And two eyewitnesses, one being Jason Baldwin's own cousin, claimed that they saw Damien commit the killing, while other witnesses would refer to it in a second-hand information manner. One of the eyewitnesses claimed that Damien stomped on it after hitting it on the head until it died, and then he cut it open and pulled its intestines out. The other said that Damien struck the dog with a brick and started jumping up and down on it until it died. Damien told the witness that he was going to come back, burn it with battery acid, and take the dog's skull. Another witness saw a dog's corpse, while a fourth would claim that Damien confessed to her that he stuck a stick in the dog's eye and jumped on it and then burned it. Damien was never charged with the killing, and no one ever came forward to claim that Damien killed their pet. Damien after the murders. So as previously mentioned, Damien would give a series of interviews to the West Memphis police in the early days following the murders. The West Memphis police claimed that the interviews showed considerable insider information on Damien's part in relation to the Robin Hood Hills murders. Urine claims. One claim made by non-supporters of Eccles is that Damien knew that two of the boys had urine in their stomachs. This was not presented as an example of Damien's inside knowledge at trial, however. Damien said in an interview on May 10th that Officer Steve Jones had told him a few days prior that the killers urinated in the boys' mouths and then placed them in the water to wash out the pee. Officer James Sudbury was with Jones on May 7th and on May 10th and made no note to correct Damien. The autopsy reports were made on the same day and did not mention urine in victims' mouths, meaning there is no chance that Jones passed this information along from the actual reports. The earliest form of this information from official sources is a letter from Gary Gitchell to Frank Peretti, the medical examiner in the crime lab. Peretti had made note that urine was found in two of the three boys' stomachs and had asked for water samples, and Gitchell wanted to know more. Urine was never referred to again on any autopsy report, except, ironically, when Damien Eccles asked for retesting of DNA in 2002, including urine found in the stomach of two of the boys. What the autopsies did initially note was that 2 ounces of brown fluid in Michael Moore's stomach lumen in Byers containing red tan fluid and chewing gum, and 2 ounces of partially digested fluid with a green vegetable substance in Stevie Branch's stomach. Two boys drowning. It is in Officer Ridge's handwritten report where it says that Damien noted that he heard two boys had drowned. Interestingly, in the transcribed report with Ridge, it only notes that Damien said he heard the boys had been placed in water and may have drowned. Damien later claimed that Ridge put words into his mouth and that he had simply agreed with Ridge, who was asking him if he thought the boys may have drowned. Mutilation. Damien said that he heard the three boys had died from mutilation wounds. He heard at least one boy was cut up and one was cut significantly more than the others. Damien also claimed that Officer Ridge fed him this information. One thing to note is that Damien was visited almost immediately after the murders had been committed and had a picture taken of his bare chest as mentioned in episode 2 of this series. No injuries were reported on Damien's body, which does not line up with Jesse's confessions where he claimed that the boys attacked Damien and Jason and fought back. Extra note, the autopsy report was received by the West Memphis police the same day of this interview on May 10th. This is worth keeping in mind. Writings. Damien wrote numerous letters to an employee from the office of his private investigator, Ron Lux, while he awaited trial in 1993. Some of the writings give the ostentatious appearance of someone slowly losing his mind. You can read them on jivepuppy.com. Many of the letters were comprised of song lyrics, taken from various heavy metal bands popular at the time. Many of the song lyrics did revolve around disturbing topics, but such is and was the nature of heavy metal music. Some of the writings, however, were original works from Damien, such as a letter written on August 27, 1993. It's a long, disjointed read. Damien jumps around to many different topics. He belabored his childhood. Here are some quotes.
I had a very sad and depressing childhood. I was always sad for no apparent reason. I cried constantly. I was always scared of everything. I tried to follow every rule exactly. When I would do something that didn't turn out exactly right, I would be horrified. Sometimes I would be so upset I would make myself sick. I was always sick with something or other. I was always completely serious and thought everyone else was better than me. I would never stand up for myself. No one paid a lot of attention to things I said, because they would all just say, "Oh, that's just Michael. Be nice to him. He has problems."
Damien then went on about his family.
In regard to my family, well, the first thing that comes to mind to talk about is when my mom and dad got divorced. I guess I should have been sad, but I wasn't. At the time, I really didn't even really care. Me and my mother and sister moved in with my grandparents. My father came to visit for a while, but then he just disappeared. I didn't really care about that either. Then my mother started seeing a man named Jack Eccles. He was really nice at first, until him and my mother got married. Then he changed. He got very, very angry over the smallest things. I think he hated me. I could not stand him. I hated him more than anything on this earth.
Damien also described possible hallucinations which he experienced. Quote,
I can remember one night when I was a little older and I woke up to see a man standing in my room. It paralyzed me. I wouldn't even blink because I knew as soon as I opened my eyes, he would be right in my face. I guess later, I must have passed out because the next thing I knew, it was the next morning. Anyway, as you can probably figure out, no one believed me. These things always happened at night.
Damien also re-emphasized his innocence, though he promised vengeance on those who had wronged him. Quote,
now, I know these idiots can never touch me. I will not stop until they have all paid for this. I did absolutely nothing, but I will be back. I will rise again in 3 days, just like the first God. Only, my message won't be of peace. It will be of war. It will be a time when everyone must pay for their mistakes. It will be the Armageddon.
Towards the end of the write-ins, Damien seems to have gotten more and more paranoid. Quote,
afterwards, I will come to power and nothing will stop me. I wrote all this down because it is easier than trying to tell people who wouldn't believe it anyway. They will all believe it very soon. Unmask, unmask. And the Red Death held sway over all. Now they take their medicine. They'll take it and they'll like it, the stupid little shits, or they'll have their brains bashed the fuck out. The fucking idiots, they think we're out to get them all. They peek through the cracks in the doors and act superior. They think we want them all. Well, they'll take their medicine now. They think I don't know they're watching me. They think I don't know about the spies and bugs. I do, goddammit. Believe me, I know. I've got spies too. I can end all of you anytime, you stupid fucks. Look, people, it's time to pay up. Now is the judgment. I am the judge.
In a different writing, Damien called himself the, quote, new messiah, claiming that everyone pays the price. In yet another letter, he said, quote, people will know I am Christ just by looking at me, unquote. In further original writings, Damien stated, quote,
I watched a movie today. It was called Bonnie and Clyde. It was good until the end when they got shot. When I saw that, I started to cry. I cried for about 3 hours. It wasn't really about the movie. But when I saw that, it was like everything hit me all at once. After I stopped crying, I let my mind go the way I can when I'm really tired. Someone came to talk to me when I did that. It was only the second time that ever happened. He made me feel a little better. It was the old man.
Damien also described the pressure building up within his body, which was enough to almost make him go into a frenzy. He finished this writing with a quote, "They will all pay." He talked about spirits surrounding him constantly and said that the medicine he was taking was making him change his body much more slowly. He was, according to him, quote, outgrowing his skin. He also complained about regular and painful headaches. He wrote to his family at the time, saying, quote,
"I need a doctor. I think I'm having a nervous breakdown, and I'm afraid to tell the people here. They wouldn't care anyway. Don't worry about me. I'm okay. Just tell Val Price or Glory Shettles that I need a doctor. Don't forget. Don't forget the doctor."
Price and Shettles were members of Damien's legal defense team, I'll add here. According to author and researcher Mara Leverett, who wrote Devil's Knot, The True Story of the West Memphis Three, an older jailer asked Glory Shettles when Damien would be transferred to a mental hospital, which they thought was important for his welfare. He apparently thought that Damien needed an evaluation as soon as possible. Trial. Damien's lawyers attempted to clean him up at trial, to create a softer or less intimidated version for the jury and general public. They cut his long black hair and began dressing him in respectable clothing. Damien also gave numerous interviews to the HBO documentary team for Paradise Lost, in which viewers would see either a sweet, intelligent goth kid, as described by Mara Leverett, or a creepy liar. He was on heavy medication at the time of each of the interviews and received significant coaching. You aren't seeing the real Damien Eccles in these interviews or documentaries. Damien would regularly blow kisses to the victims' families in court, taunting them and mocking their emotional state. He alleges that he lost his temper due to repeated harassment and being shouted at. The state took a jab at Damien's appearance in their closing statement. They pointed out that he hadn't been wearing black, his ostensible favorite color, for 4 weeks now. He must burn in the sunlight. They would also claim that the Damien during the trial was sleepy, calm, medicated, and was not representative of the true Damien Eccles. Damien would give the finger to reporters and journalists who looked his way and laugh outwardly at some of the more gruesome elements at the trial. His behavior seemed on the surface like those of a madman, a person getting off at the evil that he has committed. But Damien was also very angry. He felt the world was against him, and in particular, authority of any kind. He felt that he always had been shit on by those with power, and the trial was no exception. He was being paraded around town and in the media as an evil killer, when in fact, there was no evidence or justification for him even being there. They hated him because he was different, because he wore all black, and because he didn't fit into society's mold. Well, Damien hated them right back for all of that. So who was the true Damien Eccles? Well, it's difficult to pass. On the one hand, he lied about numerous things, such as his familiarity with the crime scene, or how many times he had been to the softball field, as was described in previous episodes. He claimed initially that he did not know the neighborhood where the victims were from, before amending this at cross-examination, that he did in fact walk frequently in the Robin Hood Hills area. He continues to make false statements to this very day, and claiming that he did not live in West Memphis, to saying that the infamous Exhibit 500 was a result of Jason Baldwin's lawyers instead of his own. Damien also admitted that he made an effort to make other people think he was crazy and scary because of being bullied at school, whilst of course always refusing to accept that he was bullied, in what I personally perceive as a psychological defense to remain in control. On the other hand, parents and friends claimed that Damien was a goofy, attention-seeking, nice kid rather than the psychopath that the prosecution alleged. Damien did have some close friends, and his mother claimed that the relationship between Jason and Damien was a fairly equal one, instead of one between a leader and a follower. Jason was not a pushover, and the two of them genuinely enjoyed each other's company and shared equal stature in their friendship. Jason's mother said much the same thing. And many of the people who knew Damien well would express shock at the thought of him being involved in the murders, saying that he just wasn't capable. He was too nice a boy, too innocent a person. The goth thing, the black clothes, the heavy metal music, it was all only skin deep. It didn't consume him. He was an average teenager for the early 1990s, just with some emotional development issues. Do you have goth friends? Perhaps you were into the goth subculture yourself. When I was a teenager, I was heavily involved in the grunge scene. Heavy punk rock music and the attached imagery, literature and associated media. I bet you and your friends had similar tastes and experiences when you were teenagers. You may have had interest in things that, at face value, or to an overbearing Mary Whitehouse-esque or Tipper Gore-type parent, might seem extreme or worrying, but in reality was just you, as a teenager, expressing your inner rebelliousness and pushing the mainstream away. Was this not Damien Eccles too? Or do you think that beneath that harsh exterior lurked something significantly wrong, something that was a time bomb waiting to go off, and on May 5th, 1993, that timer eventually exploded? Well, that's the end of episode 4. It's been our longest and most detailed series thus far, but we aren't over just yet. Tune in next week for episode 5, where we will talk about the cultural climate, other suspects, and what the hell the truth is. Until then, my friends, good night.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.